If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to Borderlines, a podcast for the discussion of Canadian immigration law. I'm Stephen Murins. This week we are joined by David Leglands, a recently retired Canada Border Services Agency officer who worked at the department for 37 years. David has been awarded the Queen's Golden and Diamond Jubilee Medals, as well as the Peace Officer Exemplary Service Medal and Bar. He worked at land, sea, air, and mail ports of entry. In this episode, I make reference to another podcast by Christian Lane called Team 10-8. Christian's podcast consists of interviews with various frontline workers in Canadian law enforcement, emergency, and military communities. His podcast can be found on all podcast platforms and is definitely worth checking out. Now, in this episode, David talks about his career with the Canada Border Services Agency, some of his more memorable cases, including when a person from India had a small bag in a suitcase that was actually labeled anthrax, the organizational culture of the Canada Border Services Agency, how David's career fostered and how a sense of compassion, or how the career with CBSA stressed to him the importance of compassion, and more. If you like today's episode, please leave a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. I hope you enjoy. Your career then, was it a mix of the land port of entry as well as airports?
Yeah, marine, airport, border. I worked in a drug unit. I worked at the post office. I was all over the map, which is really enjoyable.
And what dictates where you work? Is it there's just postings that come up and you apply, or do they send you around?
It's in districts. So if you worked in the Metro Vancouver district, you could work in marine, you could work in a downtown office, you could work at the post office. And then at the border, you worked at Pack Highway or Douglas or Boundary Bay. And at the airport, you'd either work at doing traffic operations, or you'd go out and work out at air cargo, searching bags, boxes, or going airside and searching planes as well.
So is there a lot of movement between port of entry and, say, inland enforcement?
Not particularly. You have to, for inland enforcement, you would have to apply for it, and it's run out of Vancouver, I believe, itself.
And
Western region is run out of Vancouver, or
I'm sorry,
nationally. Western region is run out of Vancouver, or even nationally.
No, just the Western region, the Pacific region. So Alberta would have their own, like the Prairie region. I think it's Alberta and Saskatchewan. They would have their own enforcement group or inland enforcement, I would think. And then the Vancouver has their own group and their office downtown.
And I guess the one thing I've always wondered is you often hear people say, oh, this port of entry is stricter, or this port of entry, the officers are more flexible. Did you find that each port of entry almost had its own personality, or was it really just a collection of individuals who are all different?
It's just a collection of individuals that are different. Because when I was there, people worked at Pacific Highway. We would also rotate between Douglas and Pacific Highway and Boundary Bay. But I think it's individual experiences. So if they go through the truck crossing and they have a bad experience, then they say, well, the truck crossing is bad, then they're going to go through Douglas. So they kind of, it's your own personal experience. So
you don't believe necessarily like one port is stricter than the others, or that a supervisor might dictate things or anything like that?
There is a lot of supervisors and there's a lot of acting supervisors. So it's not as simple as that. So, and the director at the border sort of dictates all the resources there. So the rules would all be the same. How strict they are would be all the same.
Yeah. And then in terms of like airport, marine, or land, are those border crossings also kind of all the same, where it's the collection of individuals, not necessarily a specific flavor to each one?
Yeah, exactly. It's when you work in marine, you could work, there's a couple of examination facilities where they're targeting for narcotics, and then they search, there's another spot where they search ships. So, the members move around from port to port or from office to office.
Yeah.
So it would be the same.
Yeah. What initially got you interested in working with CBSA?
I started in 1978 and completely green, but I really enjoyed the interviewing people or talking to people, learning their story. I liked searching. It was like a puzzle. So you're sort of combining what the individuals are saying with what they have. And then you start honing your skills where you're looking at the driver, sort of looking at the passengers, see when the driver says something with the passenger, how they're going to respond, like look at each other, thinking, oh, I'm going to buy it or not. So yeah, it was, I want to say it's not a game, but I challenged myself. So I liked that. And it's sort of like, it's positive reinforcement when you find stuff. So yeah.
And in the late 70s, that would have been like, were you involved with the Vietnamese resettlement?
Yes. Yeah. I started full time in 1980 in January in Edmonton, and they were already processing refugees from Vietnam, and they were chartering planes and they were bringing them into Edmonton International Airport. And then they would bring them in on buses, or they'd fly in. The buses would go out onto the tarmac and they would load them onto the buses. And then they would take them out to the Nimeo Air Force Base outside of Edmonton. And Montreal was doing something similar. They were flying into Montreal, Mirabel, and sort of doing, I'm not sure exactly where they processed them, but I suspect it would be the same situations that we had in Edmonton.
And like, what was your involvement? Was it like, what sort of questions do you ask when it's
there wasn't a
mass
a lot of
resettlement
questions
like that?
At that time, it was just processing what they had. It was kind of enlightening for me to see. I had never witnessed anything like that, you know, being from a small town, seeing a whole, you know, a culture coming into this country with nothing. And they would be taken off the bus and they would be separated between males and females. And then they would be taken into the facility and they would be showered, like they would remove their old clothes, showered, and then given new clothes. And once they had that processed, then they would come and collect whatever little belongings they had. And then we would examine their stuff and then they would be moved on. And with the immigration paperwork, I didn't follow that at all. I just know that they were being sponsored by church groups, et cetera, when they came in.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I think one thing I wish in hindsight at that time, I would have kind of done some research on that whole program of why they were being brought in, because we weren't really informed. We're just saying that, you know, not knowing that, knowing today that we would call them boat people. But in today's language, that's racist and insulting, because it wasn't just Vietnamese. It was people from Laos and Cambodia. And those people faced the same hardships as the Vietnamese, or to a degree. And they left their countries by land for the most part, where in Vietnam, most of them were put on boats. And then that, I believe there was like 250,000 that drowned trying to escape. So very eye-opening for me anyways.
Was it something that stuck with you through your career?
Yes, yes, it did. I think it helped me personally to becoming more compassionate, I think, because to see how the hardships people face from other countries, and especially coming from a small town, you just don't, you're not, your eyes aren't open to stuff like that. And years ago, before there was computers, there's very little information. Like, we would get, you know, papers to read about something. You wouldn't go on the internet and have something at your hand easily to be able to read about, right? So I look back and realizing what people had gone through to, you know, the sacrifices they made to come to this country, and how many people perished trying to do the same thing, yeah, come here.
Do you think when you start, like, if that is when you're joining CBSA and it's what you're being exposed to in your first year, does that shape, or do you think it shapes your overall perspective on your career and role different than, say, someone who's starting when there is no instance like that versus someone who's, say, starting during 9/11, like someone starting, say, during 9/11 versus someone starting during the Vietnamese resettlement or the Syrian resettlement? Do you think there's long-term implications in how that can form an officer's perspective?
I think so personally, because it's what they're exposed to. So if somebody who comes into CBS or into that environment after 9/11, and then, you know, from Western media, we're just bombarded with intel and this is happening. And I mentioned in a previous podcast is that I stopped reading the newspapers. Like, I was overwhelmed, and I'd come home and basically break down or get teary eyed, because it's like, okay, you get pushed and pushed into these with all this information about what's going on. And I personally, it was overwhelming. And I worked 9/11 when the planes were coming in, and there was so much information that was coming in about the terrorists. And of course, you're having flights with people of color and stuff, and they are coming from countries that potentially from the Middle East and stuff like that. And they were just on connecting flights, and they're like, okay, is this person a terrorist? Is this person a terrorist, right? We need to be searching everybody's bags. When we were, the airport was basically, the tarmac was filled with airplanes. And the bags didn't come in. We had to go out. The next morning I was out on a tarmac with an X-ray unit because I'd worked in a drug unit, searching bags for explosives and everything else. It was crazy, absolutely crazy. But I think I was fortunate in respect to the compassion thing of having a long career. So you see people from other countries, that from working at the border, and people coming up from Central America and from Mexico, that we're just looking for a better life, right? So, I mean, personally, I think I was very fortunate to have that experience prior to 9/11.
Yeah. Do you, because I mean, I don't want to get too contemporary political with this conversation, but like when you see now the people who are crossing at, say, Wroxham Road, which is obviously putting tremendous strain on officers there, you hear about people showing up. This is a border crossing in, I think it's Manitoba or Quebec, but you've heard about CBSA intercepting or receiving people who have had frostbite where they're missing limbs.
Yes.
And yeah, things like that. Like, to the individual officer, how do you think that would like impact them? Because I've never had that experience.
I think it's traumatizing. I think it's eye-opening and sometimes traumatizing, especially if you have somebody who's got frostbite and stuff. And that's the sad part of the where people are crossing it at unmanned, because that's not really the proper term, at actual border points, because they're finding that that's the easiest way to get in without having to go through. I mean, they'll get processed eventually, but it's sort of jumping the gun, so to speak, to get into the country. But a lot of people have suffered from that as well, by getting dropped off, and people are being taken, and it's human trafficking in a way that people are making lots of money on driving these people up to the border, dumping them off, and then heading right back and saying, you know, go down that road or cross that ditch or whatever. And it's, you know, 20 below and snow and stuff like that. But can you imagine where these people have come from that they're willing to do that to come for a better life? Yeah. And that's where personally, I think that I had a conversation probably just prior to my retirement with an American who was overtly racist. And I just said, we're both countries of immigrants, right? And I said, your lottery ticket is that you were born there. That's it, right? What would you do? And this is what I would say to people. What would you do if you were from a country that where there's war and stuff like that? Would you not want your family to have a better life? So what would you do in that situation? But I don't think the public really kind of gets that. They sort of lose sight from their everyday life and stuff. And they hear that all these people are coming in and they're going to take jobs. And that's not the case in my mind anyways. I mean, I've dealt with a lot of, I was going to say actually that when I worked for a lot of years, and I worked in a container inspection facility, and I was involved in a lot of narcotic seizures and a lot of weapons. And those are an emotional high. When you find something, it's like, yes. And if it was guns or weapons or drugs or even commodities of high value, you're like, I feel really good. Like, intercepted something, that's great. But if you have somebody that's trying to come to Canada, that's trying to circumvent immigration laws, and you catch them, there's no joy personally in my mind, because I'm doing my job. Right. And I know that they're trying to come to a better life, but my job is to actually intercept them. And then they go back to immigration and then they process them, whether they're going to send them back or whatever they're going to do. So
how did you reconcile that? Like with your human compassion versus the need to enforce the law, say. So we previously spoke with a retired inland enforcement officer named Carl Bro. And he was talking about on his end, or maybe not on his end, but at inland enforcement, they had the same, he felt that there was often the same dilemma between the cases that, you know, you wanted to enforce and you felt good enforcing versus the cases that you didn't really, and you could sort of prioritize your efforts as an inland enforcement officer, who you're going to focus on to remove, versus at the border, you have someone in front of you.
Yes.
You kind of have to make the decision there. There isn't that same luxury, it would seem.
Yeah. And I, for me personally, I would do my job. And that's where you have to kind of take the emotion part out of it. There was no joy I had a woman that came in from Russia on a fake passport. And this will stick by me as well, is that she got caught at primary when they came up to the booth, and her passport it was well done, but it was enough to concern the officer, and they sent her to immigration. And then immigration deferred their examination and brought them into the secondary area for someone to inspect her belongings to see if there was anything that would, you know, put the pieces together. And so she was presented to me, and her life, and this really does stick with me, is that her life was in this beat up old green suitcase. And inside there were her possessions. And it was like very few pieces of clothing. and a little baggie with a couple tea bags and a couple little trinkets. And that broke my heart, because that's her life in a nutshell. She's paying somebody for a fake passport. And then in all likelihood, she's going to have to pay her way once she got through. And those are the concerns are for me, is that people are being human trafficking, where these people are coming in. And it's not like they get through customs and they're here and it's, you know, it's they're good to go. They win. They don't. A lot of these poor people end up working as prostitutes, et cetera, just to pay off the debt for the pleasure or luxury of being able to come into this country.
And just to go back in the timeline a little bit. So you started with the Vietnamese refugee claims. I'll just call it that. Or not refugee claims, I guess. They were resettled refugees. And we've talked with some ministers from the early 90s who discussed how during the 80s there was a shift from the resettlement of the Vietnamese boat people, or not boat people, as you mentioned, but migrants, to tackling what was perceived to be a crisis of fraudulent refugee claims during the 80s. Did you notice that shift at all on the ground, or did that impact you? That's what they said they felt at the political level.
I personally think that it's always been that way, but because of technology, that we, when they're sending letters and stuff like that, that's all we're seeing. But now, as there's more cooperation between other countries as well, and we become more in tune of what's going on, where people are exiting other countries and trying to get into Canada. So the intel for immigration is much better, like anything else. So I can't honestly say that there's an increase of fraudulent documents, because there always has been, but I think just we're our skill set has gotten better based on a number of factors. Yeah. One of sharing information with other countries, and then also sharing documents or showing what we found, and it gets sent to across the country. Whereas years ago, if you found something and it would go to intelligence, they would write up something and then it would get sent by mail to all the ports across the country. Right. So now it's the click of a switch and everybody gets it immediately. Right. And then Intel shares Intel with other countries. So I'm not saying we're totally aligned, but we are more aligned than we were in the 70s and 80s.
So how did it work like back then? Because even if you had, you know, you'd gotten mailed, this is what a fake, I don't know, Washington State ID looks like or something. Mm-hmm. How do you, like, on the general, the stress of the day-to-day decision making, like how many people would you say when you were at the port of entry, say, I don't know if it was different airport or land, would you interact with in like an hour?
I'm sorry, of
so like how many people would you interact with in an hour, like review their documents, make a decision as to whether to admit them or not?
Easily 100, because there's a lot of pressure at the border to process traffic. So then you didn't have to present each person's passport and they would scan it. Before, they'd just be pass you all your documents. If it was from the US, you'd have driver's licenses, etc. And at the airport it'd be the same thing. And at the airport, the families would come up and you would process them as quick as possible, because there was always pressure on processing and moving on, because there's another flight, you know, people are waiting to clear as well.
How does that play out? Like, because as I have some friends who are CBSA officers, and they've said the same thing, like the big pressure on them, whether it's at primary where there's the lineup of cars, or secondary where there's, you know, only so many chairs for people to sit, is the that pressure of time. Like in secondary, how many, like either at the land or the airport, would you say was it still 100 people per hour or?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it all depends, because personally, I would talk to other officers, because I did have a fair amount of experience, and I'd just say, take the time you need, right? Obviously, they want you to process, but until you're satisfied that it's a legitimate claim coming in or for a visitor or non-visitor or a returning resident, you start your skill set gets, I think, as more you do, the better you get at it. Like your whole shtick about talking to somebody, your processing of questions. I had an individual right after 9/11 that was coming to go to flight school, and he was from India. And at that time, there was intel bulletins about anthrax was going to be spread and cause death to Canadians, et cetera, et cetera. And this individual had come up, and I talked to him. He was coming here to go to flight school. And I would always like to ask a few extra questions. I don't just pop a suitcase. I wanted to bring any gifts or anything. And I was satisfied with his story. I opened up. He had some wrap packages, and which obviously is a, you know, warning signals coming off. And then there was an envelope, and it was taped up, and I started to open it, and there was a little bit of white powder that came out. And that, so of course I was concerned, and I got the whole process of somebody watching him and detaining him and on and on and on. And he was innocently given something to bring something to Canada. And it turns, and it, inside the package, actually, when we had taken it into this drug room, it was marked anthrax, which shut the airport down. And this poor individual, who his English was actually quite good, but from the stress when he was being interviewed, cause I wasn't interviewing him. I was now separately controlling this what we thought suspected anthrax. He could not speak English. He was just so stressed. His hands were in a ball tight, he was incredibly stressed. The poor guy, actually, but poor all of us, because shut the terminal down and stuff too. But what a welcoming to Canada.
The package actually said anthrax on it. So someone,
as a joke. So inside the envelope, there was a piece of paper, and there was full of this white powder, and it was marked anthrax, like inside. So anyways, it turns out that somebody had given them this to take to Canada to give to somebody, and that individual in India thought it was a joke. So the individual in India actually got arrested by Interpol, and from my understanding, and actually served time in an Indian prison versus going to a Canadian. Yeah. So it was the last time he was going to do that kind of joke, I'm sure, but...
And what was it? And that was just like the sense you got from interviewing him, that something like, how would you have, like, what would tip you off that there might have been?
Well, I was going to open his suitcase because he was in secondary, but I wanted to find out a person's story before I automatically open a bag, because I don't know. People kind of, It's awkward, as you know, I'm sure, coming through a border or getting sent into secondary, and you're obviously you can be incredibly honest, but still nervous, because it's not something that you do every day. So this poor individual who's just coming here to go to flight school, trying to do something nice, because that's sort of a culture thing, from my understanding, is bring gifts to people here for other people, because they're not coming here. And next thing you know, the guy's, he's handcuffed, and he's exiting the Vancouver International Airport in a white, like a, have whatever the hazmat suit or whatever it is, in handcuffs, and they have him in these in paper, like he's on the front page of the Province or the Sun, I can't remember which. So this is this poor guy's introduction into Canada, but he did get released, and he got to go after that, after everything was settled. But man, anyways.
And did you process work permits, temporary resident permit applications?
No, I didn't. When after the split, or when we became CBSA and immigration and customs were sort of integrated together, there was sort of the one size fits all, that you did every aspect of the job, where I had been in a long time, and I never experienced processing, working on the immigration side.
Yeah. And so after the split, day to day, what did your role consist of?
I still work secondary and primary, and then if there's any issues, I would send them to the immigration for processing.
Yeah.
If there's concerns about their documents, or if they're coming here on work permits, and then we had people that would just process them in there.
And at secondary, maybe can you explain the distinction between like secondary and where someone applies for a work permit or a study permit? I understand at different airports, they have different terms.
Okay, so if somebody comes up to the primary booth and presents themselves with the documents, and they would tell us, they would have the documents with them, and most of the time saying that they've got documents to work here, or they've got paperwork from a university or college that's accepted them, et cetera, et cetera. And it's, a lot of that stuff would be done in advance. And then we would direct them to the immigration room to get the paperwork processed. And after they did that, then they would either exit the building or they would get sent into secondary for an examination for the bags for whatever they're bringing.
Yeah. And what about for, say, the decision to admit someone from the United States who has a criminal record to attend like a wedding or some other purpose?
They would get sent to immigration.
Oh, that's not done at secondary.
Well, if they made it through primary and they were sent for examination, and then we found documents or something was concerning to the officer, we would send them back to immigration, or we would run checks ourselves. We could do criminality checks to find out if the person had a record.
And how did that process change over the years? Because I would imagine like now you swipe the passport, there's information sharing between all these countries. In the
Not automatically, no. No, you have to do more detailed searches because there's a lot of different processes to go through for different searches for criminality, etc.
Okay.
So they would run different, I don't even know the acronyms from all this stuff now, but they would run a number of checks on this individual.
Yeah. But so that's not done at primary where the swiping of the passport. No, that's,
they don't
checks?
Have the, that goes back to the time thing, because if you did that at primary, the backlog would be, they need to move them forward to get all the, you know, I was going to say too, I want to share one thing about, we have people that come in. We had two individuals that were from Sri Lanka, and they found them in a bathroom upstairs. They had kind of, they were supposed to make it through, but they found them and they had fake pass or fake documents. And it's back to the, you know, and go back to the compassion thing, is the more experiences you have, the more eye opening it is for you. And these two individuals were considered Tamils, tigers or terrorists. And they had come in and not treated respectfully necessarily in my mind by some individuals. I won't get into details, but sometimes people say things that they don't think they understand because they weren't speaking English. Whereas personally, I want to treat everybody respectfully. And I didn't know that they spoke English or not, but it turns out, and there's a conversation with somebody, and these individuals, they did speak English, but they didn't let on that they spoke English at first, which really peeved me in regards to somebody I'd worked with that was making comments. Anyways, these poor individuals, if you talk about, you know, trying to come to a better life, when they had documents that were on their person, and they were showing, these guys had been beaten. So they were scarred where they were hung up by their ankles. They were scarred on their wrists, and they had scars on their backs where they had been tortured and whipped, and cigarette burns on their. So, you know, I know that really stands up in my mind about what hardship and stuff people are coming to or from to come to a better life in this country.
Would you say that over time there was a change in the overall culture that you were experiencing within the department?
In what respect?
Well, I mean, I think that for many practitioners, there has been a shifting gradually over time where enforcement seems more of a priority as opposed to the compassionate handling of requests at the port of entry. I'm just wondering if from somebody who has perspective inside of the department, that was something that you felt during the time there.
Personally, I didn't. I think one thing that's when I was working, when it was separate with from immigration and customs, and I didn't know all the ins and outs of what immigration was doing, but when they sort of combined the two, personally, I felt a lot more resources were being spent on the immigration side. So investigations was spending more time dealing with immigration issues than on sort of customs issues in regards to, business smuggling and et cetera, et cetera. So there was kind of a more of a shift to the immigration side. Uh-huh. But I think where immigration, I think, struggles in a way too, is that there's a lot of people that work here illegally, and where you probably heard that, where there is that on border security, there was a situation where our inland enforcement went to arrest a couple of individuals who were working up here illegally. When they went in, there was like 8 people working up here illegally. So there was a complaint from one of the individual's partners, and the episode never aired. But I think we have a problem in Canada where people are also looking for cheap labor, and they are trying to use they're taking advantage of people that are coming up here because they're not here legally, so they're paying them under the table, and they're working in construction jobs because that was the site that where they 8 people were arrested, but not even thinking about the company or the business that was hiring these people. If they were hurt, they're not covered by WorkSafe, they're not covered by anything. They're just basically cheap labor. And to me, that's pretty disgusting that this can go on.
Yeah. Do you think the department is under-resourced then? Or I guess all departments probably think they're under.
Well, I think you talk to anybody that works for us. Yeah, we need more staff.
Yeah.
I think that would be a... that part is true. And then they try to balance their resources about where their money can go and what can be spent, or there's limiting overtime, or they're, that's been an issue, I think, from the moment when I joined in 78, that there was always a resource issue. Yeah. But for the immigration side, I think they need to put a lot of resources into them for them to be able to help process. Like, I know that people that complain about coming, people that are, jumping the queue. And when I started with customs and now CBSA, I would think, wow, this person's trying to circumvent the system. And there's all these other people waiting in the queue to try to get their paperwork to come here legitimately. And all these other people are, jumping in front of them by doing, trying to get across illegally and stuff like that, but not really knowing the whole story. So it's so easy to judge without actually having all the information about.
Yeah. Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Yeah, I mean...
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just, do you think like in terms of CBSA kind of being separated from immigration? And I think on the CBSA website, it says that, CBSA officers are responsible for enforcing some double digit number of applications. Do you think that like all CBSA officers should do rotations where they're processing files and vice versa, where IRCC are at the border. Because one of the strange things now is like, it's changed a bit with COVID, but with all these applications, the people who are reviewing all the documents aren't the ultimate people who do an interview at the end, which is done at CBSA. And there's this weird gap where
there's a disconnect.
Yeah, there's a huge disconnect.
For sure. Well, even this whole notion of people jumping the queue, I'm not sometimes sure what queue it is they're jumping when there is no viability to making an application from abroad in certain circumstances too. I mean, not to say that I'm encouraging people to make an illegal attempt to enter Canada, but I think that having there be that disconnect means that those who are on the side of either the administration or the denial of admission or the removals process don't understand the unique complexity of making the applications for admission.
Okay, so let me I'll backtrack maybe in regards to using the term, you know, jumping the queue. Mm-hmm. In regards to that, where there's a long list of people who are trying to come in, sponsor their family members, et cetera. So they're waiting and waiting and waiting. And then you have people that will come through saying that they're visitors, and then they get here and then they try to or claim refugee status or whatever. So the average, you know, when I started, I would think, wow, that's just awful that these people are doing that, but not really knowing back to the compassion side or the history side of why they're doing it. Right. So, that's sort of where I was going with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And now the department's completely abandoned the notion of a queue anyways. And I mean, I know you're retired, but like right now, nothing is processed in the order that it's received, it seems.
Yeah.
So the whole notion of a queue has become more just everyone trying to crowd onto a bus with no one lining up. So what do you think the solution to that disconnect is?
God, if I had an answer, I'd be wealthy. honestly, I don't know. I personally would just like to see our people that work even within our organization become more in tune with what's going on, like educate themselves about hardships that people are facing, et cetera. And maybe they are, I don't know. I just know that from when I was working, I saw that there was some people that were very compassionate, and then there was other people that just were arrogant. We're not, no. And you know, you have, I don't know, you can't force somebody to become compassionate, but you would hope that over a period of time with based on your experiences that you would start trying to understand what people go through to try to get here. I had an individual from Indonesia who came in, presented himself as a lawyer from Indonesia, and he said that he was coming here to look at a couple schools for his wife in Quebec. And his story was, you know, he dressed the part. He had a nice suit jacket. He had a white shirt. Like, he had taken the tie off. He had, you know, the nice dress shoes. He had a laptop and stuff. And just didn't seem his story, you know, the more he asked questions, the harder it was for him to answer. And his English was fine. And opened his suitcase, and it was dirty clothing, and there was not many pieces, sort of similar to the woman from Russia. And his laptop, I just said, you know, take your battery out for me. He said, no, please, sir, don't make me do that. Cause it was just a prop. Right. And he was just trying to come for a better life as well. And again, I felt no joy of catching him. I felt sad for him, but again, I don't want to play the role of saying, well, today I'm having a bad day, so you're going in or you're not coming in. And the next day I'm thinking, oh, well, yeah, let him go. Or, but you know, you try to, I don't know, you want to follow the rule of law the best you can. And yes, those decisions weren't mine to make. But if I started making that decision saying, I'm going to let him in anyways, then it would be on me. I'd be wrong to be doing that.
Yeah. We've talked before on the podcast how there's been studies about how judges are stricter in the hour before lunch than they are in the hour after lunch and the hour before their end of day.
That's good to know.
Yeah. Well, and I think its sentences tend to be longer in the period right before lunch.
Wow.
You wouldn't notice that type of thing, but did you notice or like instances where people brought, say, stress from outside the job into the job that could impact decisions? Or if someone was having a bad day personally, it could be taken out on people going through the border?
I think so. I think that we're all human and sometimes we have better days than other days. And sometimes we would like to take some things back that we've said. That's why I always try to choose my words carefully. And I was involved with the Critical Incident Stress Management Program too. And I would say to people, don't judge anybody in this room about how they respond, because we don't know what's going on in their personal lives either. So the same thing is, we don't know what's going on in the traveler's life as they come up. They could have just lost a loved one. They could be going through a marital. There could be a number of factors, right? So you just try not to take any of that stuff personally. But I personally think that, you know, it would be very naive of me to think that, oh, everybody, we're professional the whole time, because I don't believe that for a second. Just in any field, whether you're with customs or you're a lawyer or whatever walk of life you have, you can't, you know, have a happy face all the time.
We're not designed for consistency. But I'm curious, though. I mean, you said something about hoping that officers would educate themselves. I'm interested in knowing about what efforts were made institutionally to impart that kind of compassion, or to ensure that people were processing claims or applications in a respectful way, that sort of thing. Was that something that changed over time, or you know, was it something that the department took a fairly hands-off approach about, or was it something that they did quite proactively?
I didn't think of them doing anything proactive about that. And I'm not, you know, it was way above my pay grade about how with personally, I try to keep myself informed about what's going on in the world. But I also think that that maybe the agency didn't want to, I don't know, not to skew somebody's decision-making by saying this is what's going on, because
bettering discretion, or to use
right.
The technical
I think
term.
I think
yeah.
Right, but I think that we as individuals should educate ourselves with what's going on to world events to understand a little bit more about what's going on in other parts of the world, to understand why, you know, this is a great country, and it, you know, like I said, we won the lottery by living where we're at. Other people want to have a better life. But I was fortunate to be able to have a lot of experiences dealing with different cultures coming in that were trying for a better life, that I feel I am compassionate about it. Yeah. And I can't speak for every single other person that I've worked with in regards to that, but I think it's their life experiences as well. That personally, I think life experiences make you a better officer by educating yourself, trying to understand the individual that's coming in.
Yeah. As an officer, is it recorded every time you let someone in that this was the primary officer who let that person in?
They would have a record of it, because you sign in. So it's your ID. So when you're processing, and they would know it was you that you referred them or you didn't refer them. And in secondary, you're also completing a document showing that you processed them as well. So there's that accountability, which is good, you know, in my mind.
And so if someone, say, did work without authorization or commit a crime, do they go back to that? Like, is there follow-up with the officer who let them in?
I don't believe so, because they could be, the story could be really good at primary, and you know, you're processing people. So what they do once they get out, you really can't, you have no control over.
Yeah.
I'm interested in what measures though were taken to ensure accountability of officers in the way that they handled their day-to-day job. Was that something that you said was actively monitored and mentored and that sort of thing, or again, left to a more passive perspective?
I think our process reviews are better than they were before, because it was almost like you would get a standardized review. Yeah, you're doing great, and you exceed or you're satisfactory or whatever. And now it's a bit more detailed. And when people are getting, they come on, there's more one-on-one conversations with the individual. And it's pretty overwhelming, I think, when you come into, we do like 80 acts of parliament. There's just a lot of pressure on these individuals. So when I was at the airport, I would come up to anybody I saw that was new in uniform, I'd just say, hey, give them my name and say, look, I know it's overwhelming. If there's anything I can do to help you, I will. And I'd give them my name and say, look, if I can't get the answer, I will get, or if I don't have the answer, I will get it for you, just to make them feel a bit more welcome. Whereas sometimes in an organization, you're just sort of flying out there until you can prove yourself, which really always used to bother me. Because I came into the airport, and I can say this now that I'm retired, but there was individuals who treated me terribly. Like I was like ignored. I was, and not knowing that I had found 50 kilos of cocaine on a ship, or not knowing my background or anything. And I'd been in a lot of years, but it was because I was new to that, new there. They basically blew me off like I was just some old guy, which used to really annoy me because, they had no concept or no, and I just hope that culture has changed. And sadly, I don't believe it has, but.
Yeah, I think I've seen that YVR Airport, at least as of up to a few years ago, had like reports of morale issues amongst CBSA. I never went beyond the headlines as to why that was.
But. I think that's, I can tell you that every single time they do these studies across the board, even if people are sort of happy, they say, no, we're not happy. And so the morale issue is something I think that has been going on for, and I'm sure it's in every organization as well. Morale is tough, I think, in any shipwreck operation, because you're not having Monday to Friday, 8 to 4, and you're with your family every evening, and you have your weekends off. You're working graveyard shifts. You're working 4 on, 3 off, or 5 on, 4 off. And that's where the problem is personally in organizations that don't address that or identify that you need to help individuals realize that you need to make sure you have time for your family, that work-life balance. And there was a gentleman, Dr. Kevin Gilmartin, who used to speak at law enforcement conferences, and an amazing speaker. And he was saying, basically talking about where in law enforcement, there's a lot of type A personalities, whether you're with customs or the police or, and you're going and making decisions, and then you leave your work and you don't want to make decisions because you're tired, right? And then you also start your team that you're working with, because it's a team concept, that on your days off, you're hanging out with some of your team members, because your other friends that you knew before, they're in bed because they're up the next morning, or on and on and on. So you sort of cut ties with people that were part of your life prior,
right?
which is not a good thing. So that individual is saying that you need to make like a schedule where you're going to have a date night with your spouse, or make sure you're doing stuff with your kids, and writing it down to commit yourself to do that. Because people that work in these fields, they really lose sight of everything in life. And then they can get a bit skewed in their attitudes, because they're talking about the same story. They leave work and they're talking about work, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You go to a movie, you're talking about work. And that person did this, and that person, can you imagine this, and stuff like that. And that's really a bad thing, obviously, to to continue.
Do you think people also took it, like, I assume that a lot of people, especially at the land border, are lying to CBSA officers about what they've purchased, say. Do you think that makes some officers, like, someone once described it, like a CBSA officer's career is basically at the land border anyway, being lied to all the time by people about what they bought in the States. Does that, you think, lead to people being like officers being jaded or anything like that?
It can, based on, you know, I remember dealing with somebody from at the airport, and he was a prison guard prior. And I was listening to him talk to somebody, and I called him up and I said, look, it's like 99.9% of the people or 99% of the people that you deal with here are honest. Right. To whatever degree, if they've got something small undercut, I said, you're not dealing with prisoners. Right. But they get into that mindset about everybody's lying. Right. So it would be the same thing at the border where you catch a lot of people, but it's, and sometimes I know that some people have taken things personally, and it's like, it's not personal. Right. They think like, well, you lied to me. Well, they didn't tell the truth, and they're just trying to save some tax or whatever, right? But they're it's nothing personal, right? They don't know you from Adam, anyways.
It's this sort of thing that I was kind of getting at when I was talking about cultural shifts and this idea of being jaded, and whether it's because the volumes are greater or because the risks are greater or because the technology is so much more sophisticated that there's just so much more information. But from what you're saying, it's not that this is something new, that this is something that's always part of the kind of enforcement culture, unless I'm mistaken.
Yeah, I was going to say that we get inundated with intel reports from all over the world. And I'm only speaking for myself, but just prior to my retirement, we would see a lot of stuff out of Mexico and very graphic images of people that were murdered, and not just your basic shooting, just graphic things you can't unsee. And then I decided that I'm not going to look at this anymore, because it's not going to make any difference to me doing my job. And it's not that I was ever desensitized to it, but I didn't want to overwhelm myself with that.
Right.
And then when I came back on a contract at the mail center, because we're getting a lot of fentanyl and other chemicals, I was looking back, because we get just a lot of intel stuff. And it's like, I can't do this. There's no point. How many bodies can you see? Right.
Yeah.
And then you said the lack of humanity of what people do to people. Right. So you can understand why people want to come to this country based on what they've witnessed in other countries. I met a woman who was a cleaner. She had a cleaning company. She'd worked her way from, you know, coming in on as a work permit to sponsoring her husband. And they had a cleaning company. And she said that living in Mexico City, that they slept with a handgun underneath their pillow because for fear. And I'm thinking, can you imagine us in our culture here thinking that we have to sleep with a gun beside us every night for fear of somebody breaking in and stuff?
Oh, so yeah, the conservatives during the last election had two immigration proposals that I'm curious to hear your thoughts on, not in the sense that they were conservative proposals or anything, just the idea behind them. And they were in the campaign, but the platform, they weren't really discussed in detail. So it wasn't super clear what they meant. One of them was that the only officers who could process an individual's application or interview them, this is in the immigration context, not CBSA, were people either from that background or familiar with the cultural background. And so again, it wasn't clear if they were trying to say like you could only process a Chinese person's application if you were Chinese or had taken a Chinese culture course, and they were never pressed on what it meant during the campaign. But is that something that, like, as you know, an officer yourself, when you hear a proposal like that or something similar, like kind of what's your gut reaction to the idea?
I think that's an empty campaign promise. I could always hear from whether which party, but I would be, so what you're saying is a Chinese person should be dealing with the Chinese
person?
Well,
and that's just like, they didn't specify what they meant. It was just people trained or familiar with the culture of the person or of the same cultural background.
I don't think that would be wise. I think that if they're concerned about that, then they should be sort of educating all the officers about each culture. So we're sort of on the same playing field. Because wouldn't that be awful that so there's no Chinese officers today to process somebody? That means nobody's going to get processed. We have to wait for, like, to me, that's ridiculous. I can only say, and I'm going to jump back to my time at the airport during SARS, that the ugliness of people really show through, that we had people coming back to Canada. And of course, SARS was new, and we were pretty advanced at Vancouver Airport anyways in how we were processing anybody and taking care of our officers, et cetera. But we had travelers coming back saying, how come there should be a separate line for the Asians and stuff like that. Even though they're on the same flight from California, but because they were Asian, they wanted to have separate lines. I'm thinking, are you nuts? Although that was my inner voice. My outer voice didn't say, are you nuts? I just say no, but it's like, wow. I mean, and you just, I don't know, it's so overt with people. But anyway, sorry, I keep rambling on, but.
No, it's good. It's it provides stories for each question. The other commitment that they had was that all interviews would be recorded. And so what are your thoughts on all, not body cams for officers, but like, I don't know where the cameras would be, but somehow that every interaction at secondary is recorded.
I think that's a great idea. And the reason being is because then it's not he said, she said, you just hit the button. And this is what happened.
Yeah.
100%. And what I would, you know, I see what's going on in the world, in Canada, obviously included. And I always would say that to people, every single interaction you have with the public, just think there's a camera on you. And would you be dealing with that person differently if you didn't think somebody was watching you? Really? I think that sometimes people think they can get away with stuff when they don't think that they're, and it's like in today's world, everybody has a camera on their phone, right? So they can be videoed and stuff like that. But I mean, you shouldn't have to worry about that, but you should do your job that way, that every single interaction you have, you should be able to look back and say, this is why I did that. And you can listen to this, listen to the transcript or whatever. And this is why I made that decision. And this person didn't say what they just said to you, but, and I'm sure the union would, I know the union would not like that. So what you're going to do is change my name when you do this podcast. But I that's where you run into the union stuff.
Yeah. There's,
sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like, I mean, this takes me back to the notion of accountability. And, you know, I understand that it's a high volume position and there's tons and tons of public interaction. But, you know, certainly I do like the idea of that degree of accountability and, you know, in interactions with the public. But it's interesting to note that that's not something that would have popular support within the department.
Well, maybe the heads would say that that's a great idea.
Yeah.
But from the rank and file, I just don't see them welcoming it with open arms. But personally, I think it would be run better, especially for the immigration process. If you're sitting in a room and there's an interview about it, I think that's great, because it's not like you're in secondary where there's a ton of people and you've got two counters and you have people on both sides and you're talking, and then there's not as much privacy. But if you're in a room and interviewing somebody from the immigration side, you know, go have at it. But
yeah, and you'll often see that when we are given just a transcript, like somebody's notes, you know, it leaves a lot of room for interpretation. It would be wonderful to have the actual conversation rather than the extrapolation of what was said after the fact.
Yes. Yeah.
The CBSA and notes are a lot better than the IRCC notes, I find.
That's good to know.
So, well, like you'll see, like I've seen IRCC interview notes and it's three questions and you sit there and you're like, were there really only three questions during this whole interview? Because that's all there is in the record.
Yeah. Then how come the interview lasted an hour and a half?
Well, they had tried to extrapolate those three questions. Exactly. Uh-huh. I don't know. You know what? I personally think it's a good idea, although I'm sure a lot of people would say, no, don't have that. But I know from my perspective of when you're taking notes and you're in the process of dealing with the stuff and you're trying to write notes, or you go back into a room and then you try to take notes later, you're not going to catch everything.
Oh, of course.
And that's sort of one of the things that I always had a struggle with. And this is from the critical incident stress management side, is that if somebody was involved in a shooting, they were told that you got to go sit there and take notes right away and then present those notes. But when there's a critical incident, your mind is still going 100 miles an hour and you are going to miss stuff. So either you take the notes to the best of your ability and then get ripped apart because you're going to amend your notes and then you're going to amend your report and you're going to amend your report, because the reality is once the adrenal dump is gone, then you can actually focus on exactly what was said. Wow. So taking notes at that time as well, it's pretty hard to having a conversation and trying to think, and you're trying to think what's important that you're going to write down.
Yeah.
It certainly would be easier if you had it on a recorder, but again, I don't think it would happen.
I had one other question related to what we were talking about in terms of performance feedback. Mm-hmm. I'm just really curious as to what kind of feedback an officer would be likely to get. Is it in terms of the substantive decision-making or their volume of decision-making? Are you able to offer any insight into how that process works?
It would be a number of things about professionalism, enforcement. There can be stuff where you've had interactions where you've gone out, above and beyond your duty to help people, etc. Having everything put all together, things you can improve upon. And I think those performance assessments are a lot more detailed and a lot better as the years have gone on. Like from when I started to today, or when I retired, I got to go do 16 assessments. And you could pretty much look at all, and there could be a few words changed, but they're pretty much the same, because then you can tick that off that you've got your assessments done for the year. Instead of actually using that process, which they probably would say, oh yeah, that's why we're doing this, but to actually better that employee, right? To make them a better, well-rounded individual that can represent the department and have make better decisions based on your mentoring of them.
Yeah. So how did the process improve? I wasn't quite clear exactly
originally the standard form was very basic about your performance, with satisfactory or met satisfactory or whatever exceeds.
Right.
And now there's much more into, I can't offhand remember everything, but it was much more detailed. Mm-hmm. And managers had more of a responsibility to take the time to actually do these in-depth assessments of the individual and then meet with the individual and talk about that. But for me, I acted as a manager a fair amount over the years. And if I was working with people, I would meet with each individual and I'd say, okay, what do you feel you bring the agency? And we'd write it down. What do you feel the agency needs to help you with? And then we would write it down. And then what I would do is to try to get them teamed up with other people who have those experiences or that knowledge to try to better them. But I don't see the agency doing that. I mean, I did it personally, but it didn't go over well because people are saying, oh, we're too busy, or, we have lots of people acting in management roles. Like, I think that's one of the issues for every, whether it's immigration or with the customs side or the CBS or the immigration side is that you have a lot of revolving doors with managers coming in, acting superintendents, supervisors, et cetera, where you don't have consistency, where you have a superintendent that has that team for a long period of time.
Right. But were there key principles in terms of like what were the performance metrics that people were looking for or certain, you know, you talked about professionalism and that's professionalism to the clients or within your peers or were there a whole
to the clients more so because it's all based on that. And they would not put down like performance in respects to how many enforcement actions you got this year or because then you're almost looking like a competition. So it's,
yeah.
Oh man, I got 16 seizures, so I'm good. Like I can just sit back further. So they wouldn't do that. But if there was things that you did that were significant, they would write things down with significant seizures or cases that you were involved in or whatever to sort of justify why they're giving you that performance or that type of assessment.
Right.
And just in the looking at the time, I think my last question is what's something we've discussed a lot today. What's something that you think the general public or immigration lawyers, what's a misconception that the general public or immigration lawyers or anyone has about CBSA that you would like dispelled?
Because I know my words carry a lot of weight. Thank you. Well, I think from the immigration side from the lawyer side, I think that, and this is what I would tell people that I work with, when you put on a uniform or you have a title, you gain a modicum of respect. The rest is earned, like how you do your job. Just because you wear the uniform doesn't mean you can throw your weight around, right? You need to gain respect by doing your job well. From dealing with some lawyers over the years, I've had lawyers come in with like guns blazing. And that's not really a good approach either. Like you can identify yourself in your role and that's great, but you also can listen. You don't try to kind of bully your way through based on your title. And sort of the same goes for CBSA. You don't just bully your way in because you are an officer either. So from the lawyer side, that's sort of what I would say. Actually listen to what they have to say. And if you're not being treated fairly or you're being sort of treated poorly, then ask to speak to somebody superior to that or that their manager or whatever first, because there's no excuse for not being professional. Because that's what we're paid to do, right? We represent the agency. For the public, I think even though they canceled that show, and in my mind it was boring, it was educational. So Customs was never really good about promoting what we do at all. So for years and years when I worked, they didn't want to consider us an enforcement agency, that we were tax collectors. So the public didn't know that we arrested people for narcotics. They didn't know any of that stuff, or the general person didn't. So I think the public is a bit better educated in what we do. I think that the agency could publicize successes that we have. And I think we've gotten better at that too, because a lot of seizure actions where you have the police arrest and they've got, you know, 150 kilos of cocaine or whatever. A lot of times customs is there at the press conferences. They make themselves available as well. But for years and years and years, we didn't take any, I'm going to say credit, but we got no publicity. It was like the RCMP sees this or such as this, even though it was our files that we found it, but they did the controlled delivery. So we were never part of that. So the agency, I think, has gotten a bit better with that. But I don't know. I just would like to see that the public would be more made aware of the successes that we have as an agency.
Going back to that lawyer's question, you mentioned that the
did I hit a nerve?
No, it brings me back to the conversation with Carl, because you'd said that the uniform brings a modicum of respect. And something that I asked him was, did he care if the lawyer wore a suit and tie? And so I'm curious, since you mentioned that the uniform brings that, you know, the first sign of respect, but then it's earned after that, would would what a lawyer was wearing have impacted anything?
Not for me personally. No. Not at all. Just as long as they identify themselves and I know it's yes, being respectful. I think we from all professions, sometimes we come in saying like I'm this or I'm that. And it's like, yeah, that's nice. But right? So you don't want to get off on the wrong foot anyways. Because I don't know. Then it sort of puts up everybody's guards are up right away instead of trying to work at. We're all stakeholders in this. Like everybody has a role, right? That's you're representing a client. The client is wanting to come in. They want to and we're trying to process them and seeing if it's a legitimate claim or not. I mean, but we can all be respectful for each other.
Yeah.
Good.
No, that's good to know. That's been a consistent answer. And it's surprising how often I get asked the question from junior lawyers, what should I wear to CBSA? So.
Wow. Well, that's actually nice. I mean, at least they're asking, right?
Yeah. No, this has been very informative. I'm glad that I discovered you on Christian's podcast.
Thanks for discovering me.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it, actually. I was grateful to have the career. Lots of variety.
Yeah.
I think I developed more compassion, actually, by just seeing where other people come from. And I sort of wish the public as a whole in this country would take the time to actually try to, before they make assumptions about somebody coming in, actually look at the background and realizing that we are blessed by living here, right? It's not perfect, but it's certainly a lot better than what's going on around the rest of the world.
No, I think about that every time I'm stressed about, some aspect of living here.
Yeah, that's exactly what I've been doing too. Everything we have here is a first world problem.
Oh yeah.
It doesn't take much to turn on the news and see what's going on. I mean, it's not all, whether you think it's fake or whatever, but to see the images and stuff like that, you can't unsee them. My heart goes out to Ukraine right now, especially. But it's not the only country where people are suffering either.
Yeah.
So I really hope that the country welcomes as many immigrants as possible. We need immigration. And the sentiment that's been sort of filtered from the U.S. disgusts me with the white supremacists, et cetera, and Canada first and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, your relatives are probably, immigrants, right? So my grandparents came from Eastern Germany prior to the Second World War, and the abuse and everything that they took because their culture and then the war's on and stuff like that. They had nothing, and they had to scrape and scramble to get, to where they were. And, we being born here, for the most part, have never had to think about anything like that. The last thing I was going to say is that at 9/11, we were, they're worrying about terrorists, et cetera, et cetera. And it was devastating, obviously, that two towers went and collapsed and 2,000 people plus died. But I said, that is awful but it hits home because it's in North America. I said, but so we're inundated with that and we're like, oh my God, this is awful. But 6 months prior, there could be a tsunami somewhere else and a few thousand people die and you're going, well, that's sad. And then you go to the entertainment section of the paper, or you go to sports and stuff like that. And you don't give it much thought, right? So until it actually hits close to home, you develop a bit more compassion.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.